you're with us for the morning show as we examine how the playbook for political communications is being remastered by the White House. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. So we're spending the hour on how public officials communicate, especially Dr. Anthony Fauci and his ability to build trust and get messages through partisan politics. So this is a headline I caught in The Atlantic yesterday. America is thirsty for Anthony Fauci. What is it about a crisis that can turn even a 79-year-old immunologist into a heartthrob? End of headline. Do you see an opportunity to move beyond political polarization because of the coronavirus? Or are you worried politicians are trying to exploit the pandemic for political gain? If so, what statements trouble you? We're at 800-642-1234. Kathleen Hall Jameson is a communication professor at the University of Pennsylvania, where she is director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center. She's a graduate, by the way, of Marquette and UW-Madison. Kathleen, welcome back to Wisconsin and the Ideas Network.
It's good to be back virtually. It would be good to be back physically, but maybe sometime in the future.
Sometime one day off. Well, bird's eye view first. What do you think of the way government officials are communicating information to the American people about the pandemic?
Depends on which officials. I think, you know, Anthony Fauci did something extraordinarily important when very early he visualized, literally visualized with his hands, what it meant to say bend the curve, as he talked about the importance of what is alternatively called things such as shelter in place, which is a little odd because you usually think of that in terms of terrorist attacks, or stay at home or social distancing. But just that simple visualization took a very complex statistical concept and clarified it for the American people. I think Anthony Fauci overall deserves thanks from all of us for being effective at communicating.
Well, there are a lot of new words in our vocabulary these days. All of a sudden, we're all talking about flattening the curve and who's asymptomatic and social distancing. What does all that mean to someone who studies our words and what they do to each other?
Well, the first thing is when scientists understand something as a phenomenon, they have to translate it into language that lay people who aren't knowledgeable about the specifics can understand. And when the social scientists began talking and the medical personnel talking about social distance, they picked the wrong adjective. What they meant was we should engage in physical distancing. We don't want to distance ourselves socially. We want to find ways to stay in touch socially with the people who help sustain our lives, who give us a sense of family and community and neighborhood and ultimately nation. And so to the extent that we conventionalized social distancing as the request, stay 6 feet apart, we got our adjective wrong. We should transpose that in and make it physical distancing and signal physical equals 6 feet. And when you say two arms length, well, no, actually, that depends on how long your arms are. as we think through the really simple signaling mechanisms, it becomes important that we all adopt the clearest language that we can. I was standing in a pharmacy line shortly after they began to use the term socially distanced, and we had not yet been told we should be staying at home, et cetera. And there was a person who was crowding in behind me in the line, and I just, looking forward, because he's behind me, I'm not going to turn, I said, physical distancing, please, 6 feet. And he said, I'm socially distancing. Well, he thought he was. He was maintaining what he thought was an appropriate social distance, but he was probably taking that as how far apart we usually should stand when we're talking to strangers. He was, by the way, talking on a cell phone in the process, so if you're worried about aerosolized virus, you should be some concern having him that close to you behind you. So there's a lack of clarity in the signaling, and people of goodwill as a result earlier in the process may have trouble getting it. I think most of us have gotten it now. But what it says to us long term is we should think ahead as we're going to be making recommendations and ask what's the clearest, quickest way that I can get what's in my intended meaning in my head into your intended action.
Well, Kathleen, you know, trains left the station because social distancing is now embedded in our communication, embedded in our vocabulary. So is there anything you can do to even reverse that?
Every time you hear yourself about to say social distancing, remember that by virtue of being our public radio station, you are our social contact. And we don't want you to be socially distanced. I'm really happy, by the way, to have my NPR station sitting right now for practical purposes a foot and a half away from me on my kitchen counter. And every morning, the first thing I do when I come downstairs, before I open my iPad to read my news aggregator, I turn on NPR. Socially, NPR has never been closer to me. I can literally reach out and hug my radio. So for practical purposes, NPR hasn't socially distanced from me. It's brought me closer to the hosts whose voices I've recognized as I used to engage in drive time behavior. So I think we need to be thinking, as we hear ourselves saying social distancing, click, we mean physical distancing. Social distancing, we want all this good social contact we can get. Just keep it 6 feet away if it's in person.
Talking with Kathleen Hall Jamieson, a professor of communication at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication. We're talking about political messaging, messaging of all types coming through the pandemic. We're sorting it out, especially as public officials hold press conferences every day, news conferences, and so many of the American public join in to watch. What are you seeing in the messages, and are you abiding by them? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in David now, joining us from Middleton. Hi, David.
Hi. I'd just like to make a comment. There is a really good book by Naomi Klein called Shock Doctrine, and in it she shows how during political times that are put the public off balance, that seems to be when politicians like to get through policies that might not be really beneficial for the public, knowing that they're already off balance, and that seems to be a time to push things through. So I would really recommend people stay on Wisconsin Public Radio to really understand the subjects, to really look towards the experts, and not listen to the politicians who are saying that you need to listen to us because we know what we're doing, and their policies might not really be beneficial for us. If she could comment on that, please. I'll take my comment
David,
online.
Yeah, thank you so much. Kathleen, what about pushing through policies at a time of crisis?
Yeah, there's an axiom in politics that politicians never, quote, waste a good crisis. And by never waste a good crisis, some mean it's an opportunity while everybody is concerned about acting and acting now and acting quickly and acting at large scale is an opportunity to put into budgets things that might not have gotten into the budget if there had been a longer deliberative process focused solely on those elements. There's another concern in times of crisis that a frightened public and a legislator anxious to act may not put in place the curbs that are necessary to protect civil liberties and to protect the executive from overreaching. And so there's always a worry when you get in times of crisis that you're going to have a move toward more autocratic system, toward more centralized control, and that it will be difficult to take it back when you get into more normal times. And I think those are arguments for vigilance. But we also have a situation now that's really somewhat different from those situations in the past when we've had crises, because we are so polarized now that our level of trust in people of the other party is highly diminished. Mm. And so the tendency is to believe that the people on our ideological side of the aisle must be doing what's right, and those on the other side must be doing what's wrong, instead of stepping back to ask, what actually would you think is the best thing to do with if you did not know what the party of the person was who is making the recommendations?
We're looking at political messaging this hour with the University of Pennsylvania communication professor Kathleen Hall Jamieson. Here's President Trump's message last week when he extended social distancing guidelines.
You would have seen people dying on airplanes. You would have seen people dying in hotel lobbies. You would have seen death all over.
What questions do you have about the messages coming from the White House? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Trump has dominated headlines with the daily White House briefing on the pandemic crisis. He and his coronavirus task force, prominently featuring Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, they've held these daily press briefings attracting millions of viewers. We're looking at the messaging and the politics at play with your insights. How do you see the coronavirus pandemic affecting the presidential campaign, the makeup of Capitol Hill? Are Americans affected by the messaging from elected officials that perhaps translate to the ballot box? Join in at any point, 800-642-1234. We have University of Pennsylvania Communication Professor Kathleen Hall Jamieson as our guide for the hour. Kathleen, the president and many governors have given, almost daily press conferences, briefings. Have these briefings been successful in conveying both the danger and how to keep people safe? What do you make out of these briefings?
It ought to be comforting to hear leaders clearly and accurately tell us where we are, where we're going, and what we're doing. A problem occurs when the information offered in these briefings proves to be untrue, and expectations are raised, and then they're not realized. So to the extent that the public health officials have given us good, accurate information, they've been helpful. But there have been times in which the president has led us to believe that things are happening that actually weren't. And that's problematic because you need high levels of trust in leadership to tell you what's actually going to happen and what is not and when you can expect it and under what circumstances you can actually get access. So leading to people to think that they can get tested when they couldn't in places that are not yet available, in locations in parking lots that actually hadn't been implemented, that's problematic. On the other hand, it is important that leaders stand up and tell us that action is being taken that does address our needs. And the president and the Congress did take action that allayed our concerns, to some extent at least, about the economic dislocations that are occurring as a result of the corona pandemic. And that was very important. It was important to see leadership say those things and do those things. Important not only because the president did it, but because the Congress did it, and it did it on a bipartisan basis. The other thing I'd like to note is that when these long briefings happen, there are numbers that we're hearing that need to be kept in context. So my advice to everybody who hears any number about coronavirus, COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2, whatever it is you're calling it, ask what is the denominator and keep things in that denominator's perspective. So when you hear this number of people have died, we have this number of cases, the question is, how many people do you have who have it who aren't reflected in the case number? The cases are those who are diagnosed. How many people have tested and have been tested negative? Now, you at the top of the hour actually told people about the negative testing. That's really important information because it tells people this isn't 100% of everyone everywhere, which needlessly raises anxiety, but the death numbers and the case numbers give us an anchor point to say, here are points of concern, as long as we remember others have it who don't fit in that case number. It's also important to remember that there are people who have recovered from this. And if you look at the Johns Hopkins site, which is keeping track of numbers, they have a recovery number as well. As we remember the recovery number, as we remember the negative testing number, we can keep the deaths and cases in context, and we can, as a result, realize we're accomplishing something by staying at home, by keeping physical distance, and we also have reason to hope that as a result we are, new language, bending the curve, and that there's going to be a way through this as science finds a way to treat and science finds ways to vaccinate.
We're talking with University of Pennsylvania's Kathleen Hall Jamieson. She co-founded factcheck.org in the early 2000s, getting your insights on political messaging along the way at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Jeff now, joining us from Appleton. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. In listening to the brief summary to bring this guest on, I have to object with the framing of this in any type of political lens. This is not a political thing. This is supposed to be all of us. And trying to frame this as politics, it just separates people. And I guess one thing in talking with the numbers, I'd like to see, I haven't seen the survivor number of people that have recovered is one number I haven't seen very often. I've started to see it, but it is something that I do like to see. It gives a little bit of hope.
Jeff, thank you for the call. Kathleen, is it possible to separate public health from politics?
The question you were phrasing at the beginning, I heard as, are we going to be able to put polarization behind us and put the kinds of political infighting that we're characterizing our politics aside as we move forward? There's always going to be some political dimension when our leaders have to act and our leaders wear a political party identification in addition to an office identification. But we need, I think, to remember, and the caller is making that very important point, that there are very few moments in which we are as conscious as we are right now that we're all in this together. I mean, the virus doesn't know party label. The virus is perfectly happy whether it's in a Democrat or a Republican, and we would like it to not be in either. And we don't want it to be in any independents. We don't want it to be in anybody who is not registered by party, because all of us are affected by whether or not others are affected, and our behavior affects them as well. So if there's a time in which we can ask the larger question, what does it mean to be in together, this is that time. And I like the caller's framing of it, because I am seeing at my local community level something I always knew was there, but I'm not ordinarily as conscious of. We are seeing neighbors knocking on doors of older citizens, saying, older individuals, saying through the distancing of the doors, the glass doors, saying, I'm going to the grocery store, can I bring you something? We are seeing individuals who are reaching out to make sure that others in their neighborhood are all right. You're seeing families creating kinds of play groups online that they hadn't actually created in physical space, but they're actually physically proximate to each other. They're just kind of down the block. We've always known, even as things in Washington seemed as if the divisions couldn't possibly get worse, that at the local level, this country was still behaving really well in most places. I always said, when people said polarization, oh my God, what can we do? What can we do? Look down to the mayoral level, look down to the city level, and what you'll see is a whole lot more of neighbor caring about neighbor regardless of partisan identification, and mayors being able to mobilize forms of action that are for the collective good. I think keeping all of that in mind and then generalizing that behavior out into the broader community once we come out of staying at home is one thing that we can hope for out of this crisis, because we don't think, based on the best available medical evidence, this thing is going to go away in the foreseeable future. It may go into seasonal outbreaks until we've got treatment and we've got a vaccine. And under those circumstances, remembering all those lessons we learned about caring for each other because we're all in it together are going to be important, not just for us, but for everybody else.
Oh, you're saying, you know, helpers come out of the woodwork, certainly in the neighborhood level, the community level, and you can also perhaps start to see that radiating eventually upward and outward.
Yeah, and you also, you're seeing individuals who are going beyond the requirements of their job. I mean, before I picked up the phone to talk with you this morning, I got a call from, and I'm going to mention the name, a Costco representative in an optometry department who has a pair of glasses that I should have picked up just as we were being told to shelter in place. And I took the advice seriously, and I immediately stayed at home. And shelter in place versus stay at home versus safer at home, by the way, are really interesting linguistic distinctions. I like telling people safer at home, please, as opposed to ordering people, you must stay at home unless absolutely necessary. But this person in the optometry department at Costco called this morning and said, we realize that you've been calling to see if there's any way to get your glasses, and you're not able to leave your home. We're going to find a way to mail them to you. Now, Costco is a big anonymous corporation as far as I'm concerned. I have a Costco card. I have all sorts of other cards. Here's a human being who looked in his bin of glasses, said, oh, I bet these haven't been picked up because she can't get here, took on his own initiative with his manager's consent, finding a way, he's going to mail me my glasses. Now, there's a moment of human connection there that makes me feel better about everybody in the world today. Thank you, person at Costco whose name is Ruben.
Ruben, yeah, and there are so many Rubens out there who are going that extra mile, and certainly in the healthcare community as well, where people are going way above and beyond to help their neighbors. You know, as you look at the communication going on where people can't hug, where they can't get close to one another, how does that affect communication?
It increases the importance of our staying in touch online and are finding ways to put into words expressions that we used to carry with physical proximity. Yeah, we need to find a way to translate the hugs into the words online, into the chats online, into the Skype time, the FaceTime online. We also need, I think, to find ways to express our thanks and gratitude to the healthcare workers, the emergency service personnel, the people in the grocery stores and the pharmacies, the people who are keeping our mass transit working. These are the people in society whom we take for granted. And you know, my view of this right now is that the nation collectively owes them a kind of debt of gratitude, and we do individually. The extent to which I can go to a store, stand 6 feet in line, wearing my mask and wearing my gloves, and there is product on the shelves, is because a whole lot of people in that supply chain went out and did jobs and took some risk in the process of doing that. And I think as we think about all the people we're going to be grateful to and grateful for, we need to find ways to verbally and in other ways express our thanks. And among the ways we can express our thanks is to try to ensure on the back end of this that these people are being paid a living wage, that they have health insurance, that they...
We have to pause right there with Kathleen Hall Jamison on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A quick signpost here. WPR has added additional newscasts each day. You can hear them at the top of the hour. We have a hive of pandemic-related articles, data, analysis. It's all at WPR.org/COVID. Right now, we're looking at political messaging and the pandemic. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has launched a new special committee to oversee trillions of dollars in emergency spending. Other top Democrats are pushing legislation to create a commission looking into whether the government properly responded to the outbreak. And political pundits are saying congressional Democrats face pressure to show voters they're staying engaged and they're taking action to combat the pandemic during a critical election year. So, are you worried that political polarization makes it more difficult to respond to this crisis? How is the press doing, by the way, in covering the TikTok, the order of events as they unfold? You can be part of this. 800-642-1234. We have University of Pennsylvania Communication Professor Kathleen Hall Jamison, who stays with us, and her most recent book is called Cyber War. Let's take another call now. Jeff is here from Pleasant Prairie this morning. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, good morning.
Good
morning.
Yeah,
I just wanted to comment on the previous Jeff had mentioned that it should be more of a public health response rather than political. And I guess in an ideal world, maybe on the planet Vulcan or something, that could work. But I think our main problem comes from the president himself. When you're watching his press conferences, he uses, when he's not reading from the page and he's ad-libbing, it's nothing but self-praise, the best ever or whatever superlative he wants to use effort that he's doing, and shifting the blame often onto the previous administration. And, politicizing the whole thing is coming right from the top.
Jeff, thank you for the call. You know, Kathleen, this Jeff is saying the president is scattered in the messages and not consistent about them.
Yeah, the first question is, should the cable news networks be covering those press briefings from front to back, or should they be treating them as news events from which they extract the important information and then feature the important information as they would if they were assembling a newscast based on an extended event? And I believe they ought to be doing the latter, because there is important information across those briefings. And the question is, first, should anybody be expected to watch at that great length in order to find it? And the answer is no. We should be doing other things with our time. Among other things, taking that much time to focus on coronavirus simply isn't healthy. Focus on family, focus on other kinds of activities, focus on listening to music, focus on doing your job. But spending that amount of time focusing on coronavirus is not productive for anybody other than news people. And their job is to figure out what is the important news there. The news is anything that is telling us about the state of public health, about what we know about available treatments, about what we know about the legislative response to this, and about what we can reasonably project and when government is going to act and how. And if one could say that, every evening I should be able to tune in and pick up a kind of top-of-the-hour summary of what those the answer to those questions from those briefings. There would be no reason for anyone except news to pay any attention to them. On C-SPAN, it's fine if anybody wants to watch them. But that they're taking extended cable time is, I think, a mistake. And you're seeing some cable channels beginning to try to treat them as events that should be digested to their most important meaning and then should be scrutinized to make sure that the statements that are being put through the news are, in fact, accurate, at least put into a context so that they can't be misinterpreted. There is a danger in this moment that because the president is able to command that kind of attention, that we get a political messaging structure in that time as opposed to a public health structure in that time, health messaging structure in that time. And I think that's the other reason for concern. You basically have unequal access to the airwaves right now for the president of the United States, who is the Republican incumbent and presumptive nominee of his party, and whomever the presumptive nominee of the Democratic Party is going to be once the primaries work that out. And that's creating an imbalance in messaging that is potentially problematic. Problematic if you're concerned on the Republican side that some of those messages from the president are not as coherent and accurate as they might be, or problematic on the Democratic side if you're concerned that there's not a kind of comparable capacity for the Democrats to create an alternative vision of what their leadership would look like.
Well, on the strand there on media coverage, I have just been floored by the data science journalism that is out there, the number of mapping and complicated mapping structures that we're seeing across so many media outlets. But often when I look at these maps and the data analysis, it's difficult to understand what it is telling me.
Yeah, and we moved into data journalism within the last decade with a vengeance. And we have many fine people who are really, really good at using available data sets and trying to localize them, which lets them move into local news markets, and county, state markets, state markets, et cetera. So you now have capacities to generate data that have outstripped the ability to communicate it well to people on the other end. So there was one of the graphic illustrations that went up yesterday was a state-by-state, large-city-by-large-city projected death per capita at the peak of this. And I looked at that and said, what's the likelihood that a person unschooled in analyzing these kind of data and these kind of formats is going to realize that that is a per capita per day number? That is not a per capita in total number. And what's the likelihood that people are going to be able to see what a 0.2 per capita per day actually means as the peak shifts across a graph? It's not that that wasn't intelligible to the scientists who work with those kinds of data. It's that the layperson who sees that coming through news may actually misinterpret it to say, oh, look, the Philadelphia number is 0.2. Wow, Philadelphia is really safe. Well, no, that's 0.2 per, it's per capita per, I think it was per 100,000.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Not per capita, per 100,000. So you need to get the denominator right, which I just didn't do, per 100,000. And now generalize that back. That's actually not a reassuring number. It's a number that says, okay, let's try to keep it as low as we possibly can. The other thing you run the risk of with that sort of thing is people start going city by city and saying, oh, look, it's safer to be in Philadelphia per 100,000 per death per day per peak period than in some other city. That's not useful. If you look at that and say, oh, I feel relatively safe, and then you engage in behaviors that are counterproductive and they make you and everybody else less safe, then having access to those data didn't help. They hurt. So I'm impressed by the quantity and the academic quality, but in some cases not by the level of sophistication in communicating it well to the lay public that, filled with anxiety, might be seeking out information and might inadvertently misinterpret.
We're talking with University of Pennsylvania Communication Professor Kathleen Hall Jamieson about all aspects of the messaging around the coronavirus and the pandemic here as we look to understand it on the community level, in our own personal households. You can join in with the messaging that has caught your attention and what you are holding true to? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kathleen, let's shift gears here for a moment and look at Wisconsin, which went ahead yesterday, held its presidential primary, national focus on our state despite the pandemic. How important is it to carry on the basic functions of democracy during a public health crisis?
Yeah, we always have to balance values. So what is the value of having the regularity of the election on the cycle that was projected with the structures in place that are able to execute at that time, as opposed to the value of keeping the physical distancing required at the peak of a pandemic to ensure that everybody remains as safe as possible? And those value judgments are going to lead to different conclusions. And you know, reasonable people are going to differ about them. So we're now going to see the ways in which people process their perception of risk and all of the other constraints that they feel in the environment, yielding very different judgments. I am biased toward trying to say, all things being equal, your job is to protect the public health. But the question is, are you going to make the same decision about the general election that you would during a primary? I'm more comfortable saying one might postpone a primary than I am saying we might postpone a general election, because the general election has deadlines attached to it about actual transfer of power in a way that a primary election does not. But I think we need to be open-minded and sympathetic as people make these judgments, recognizing that there are arguments on both sides, and our perceptions of risk and our underlying value structures and priorities are going to determine what we think is the best thing to do.
Well, the Democratic National Convention was supposed to be held in July in Milwaukee. It has been moved for the time being to mid-August. What do you see there? Because changes in how the political parties ramp up and hold their conventions and communicate at their conventions in person, that is a big part of political party dynamics in our country.
It is. And the part of the problem is that the very concept of a convention is that you're bringing the people who are designated to be able to vote from all over the country into one location to act collectively to represent all of those voters who cast the ballots that they are now speaking for, in an environment where we can all ratify this and see that it is democratic and it is working, and in that environment collectively affirm that that party has selected that individual. And so a question as we discuss moving to a virtual convention is, how do we retain the sense, the symbolic sense, but important symbolic sense, that the balloting is actually representative of the votes that were cast, of the decisions that were made across the country, and that it is being fairly cast in an environment that allows the kinds of deliberation that might have occurred on the floor or in the convention environment to still take place if the outcome is not already clearly predetermined by the existing numbers, as it very well may be. So that's the first concern. It's that we clearly communicate, if we're going to do this virtually, that the symbolic functions are being discharged and the actual functions are being discharged. But secondly, there's a plus side to the COVID pandemic. If we are still largely at home in that environment, and I hope in August that we are not, we have the opportunity to have an unprecedented number of viewers for both the Republican and the Democratic conventions.
Well, let's pause there. Spending the hour with University of Pennsylvania Communication Professor Kathleen Hall Jamison. We'll be back right in a moment on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're spending the hour on political messaging, what it means. Be clear, consistent, and accurate with your message. Those are some of the tenets that public health officials talk about when they want to get people to change their behavior. And the president's shifting messages has some public health officials concerned. Social media may become even more critical to the presidential campaign because of the pandemic. Are you concerned about possible manipulation from Russia or other outside actors, like what happened in the 2016 election? Still time for you at 800-642-1234. University of Pennsylvania's Kathleen Hall Jamison has spent decades studying political communication, and she's our guide. Kathleen, let's pick up where we left off as the campaigns look to social media to get their platforms out ahead of the election. What are you watching there? Will social media and TV advertising play an even bigger role?
Well, for the moment, they're playing a smaller role because the candidates have virtually given up mass media advertising because it would just seem inappropriate in the middle of a pandemic. But before talking about changes in social media and campaign, let me note two other things about conventions. If we're still largely staying at home or physical distancing, we may see an increase in viewership of both conventions. And if one or either of the conventions is virtual, as opposed to taking place in physical space with lots of cheering partisans, we may see the convention acceptance speeches and nomination speeches written more for understanding of the issues and the platforms and less to elicit applause lines from perfervid partisans. That could be a rhetorical change that is noteworthy. Convention speeches tend to be punch-ups of one-liners that are trying to get applause. That doesn't create the likelihood that you're going to get much learning about where the candidates are actually standing on issues. They're trying to arouse and create a sense of alternative vision without creating a clear understanding of what it is. A speech not written for that kind of audience because it's not there cheering in person might actually give us a more substantive understanding of the candidates, their platforms and plans, and also increase the likelihood because we're less likely to be in movie theaters and malls that people are actually going to watch. As to your social media question, what I'm watching for is the extent to which the platform's disclosure of the advertising makes it possible for us as journalists. I run factcheck.org. Eugene Kiley is the person who actually does the day-to-day operations. I'm ultimately responsible for it. But we're really concerned that we can find all of the advertising that might be manipulating people and is false. To the extent that the platforms have said they're going to put it up so that we can find it, we should be able to do a good job checking it as long as there's not so much of it that it overwhelms us. So I'm looking to the platforms to keep their word about making it accessible so that we can fact check it, so that we can try to hold it accountable if it's blatantly deceiving micro-targeted audiences.
Let's bring in another call now. Sylvia is in Clear Lake this morning. Good morning, Sylvia.
Good morning, and thank you for taking a look at this issue. I was in public relations for over 40 years, 20 of those specializing in crisis communications to clients all over the country. And I want to agree and disagree with your guest, respectfully. One, I disagree that people should not be looking at those briefings. I have been looking at them sometimes for an hour, sometimes for a little longer, maybe not every day. But when I look at the entire briefing and then I hear the summaries that may come at the end of the day, at the late news, I've been amazed at how different my understanding of what I heard and the summary occurs. Because very often those summaries begin with headlines, conclusions, and I do not always agree with those conclusions. Whether it's CNN or Fox, they all come with their biases, and those show up a lot in those summaries. Now, if I could trust all the summaries, that's what I would do, as you suggested. Take a look and wait till the end of the day. But boy, I have been shocked at how different what I saw and understood is from what those summaries look like. But I did want to agree with you on something you said earlier, which is about good communications at the very beginning, at those briefings. At the start of all of this, I could not believe how bad all the communications was. It's like nobody had ever understood what good communications during a crisis is about. And we've had enough ups and downs in this country to know how you enter into the initial communications when there is a really bad thing going on. Mm. You can provide hope. You can provide calm without making speculation.
Well, Sylvia, yeah, like I want to throw it back, toss it back here to Kathleen, a two-pronged approach here with Sylvia's comments. First, though, on watching these briefings and the takeaways and how journalists filter it out and condense it.
Yeah, journalism is not a single thing. I put the cable category in one box. I put mainstream broadcast in one box. That is network evening, half-hour news, ABC, NBC, CBS, NewsHour. I put radio in one box, and then I put mainstream print in one box. mainstream print has done a good job digesting what is important in those. In the main, so has mainstream broadcast. Now, in the process, some things are going to be filtered out. They're just not going to get in because mainstream broadcast has basically a half hour in order to communicate. PBS NewsHour has done a good job with commentators about the content, sometimes in real depth on some specific points. And I don't disagree if someone has the time to watch the briefings and if doing so isn't raising your anxiety level needlessly and causing you to focus on the virus in ways that are making it harder for you to live the rest of your life. I don't have any problem with people doing it. But rather, I'm concerned about taking that amount of time in cable space that could be devoted to something else. And there the aspiration ought to be to digest the things that are important and reiterate. And in particular, if you're doing the briefings and you don't feel the obligation then as a result to do that kind of digesting, because, well, everybody just watched the whole briefing, the people who aren't able to watch the whole or can't pick what's important out of the whole are not going to get what's important from it. So I don't want cable to give up its responsibility to be the place that digests down important information, such as we now ought to be wearing masks. And here's why we ought to be wearing masks. Now, that's a change in what they're telling us. And the fact that it's a change can actually be seen as problematic because it can be looked at as, well, they maybe knew it all along and just didn't tell us because they didn't have enough masks, or they got new information that the virus is aerosolizing. But nonetheless, I want to make sure that as a result of that briefing, that announcement, that everybody watching every form of news gets the digest, gets the, and then that news tells us, and everybody else, thank you, social media, for doing such a good job, tells us if you don't have masks in storage, and you shouldn't, those masks, if they're medical masks, belong in hospitals, how do you make a mask to protect yourself and protect others? So that's what I'm saying. There has to be a digesting function in news that reiterates what's important and then deepens and also creates context and polices for accuracy if there's an accuracy issue. And that's important when you hear recommendations about uses of medications that have not yet been approved for the use that is being articulated by the President of the United States. We don't want people to be using medications unless it is medically advised for them. There are complications from these medications that are very specific to individuals' conditions. And you want to make sure that that's the message if you're going to talk about them, and that you're clear about what level of evidence we currently have about their efficacy in relationship to COVID-19. And that evidence is limited at this point. So you don't want people to be overgeneralizing because they watched the briefing and didn't get context from news.
Kathleen, in less than 30 seconds or so left, you study misinformation and disinformation. As you look in the U.S. and around the world, are you concerned about what could happen with disinformation and the pandemic?
Yes. You have conspiracy theories that are being pushed aggressively right now across social media. One says the United States government military created this and dropped it into Wuhan. Another says this is a bioweapon engineered by the Chinese. Spread. You can go from there. We have to worry about, in times of fear, uncritical propagation of information that's harmful, that can decrease trust in institutions on which we need to rely, and in the case of CDC and NIH, I believe should rely in times of health crisis.
Kathleen, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Kathleen Hall Jamieson, a professor of communication at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication and director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center. If you missed any part of the conversation, you can stream the hour at WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, it's On Point, what you should know about the Defense Production Act. On Point has that. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.